In the space between the outer doorway and the inner vault door, illuminated in red lighting, stood a jet-black Harley-Davidson lowrider.
John Rourke personally rode this motorcycle during many of his heroic exploits, usually parking it in this very spot. Now watch your step, because this is real rock, and sometimes it gets very slippery.
Dutifully, he watched his step, taking the young lady's elbow, to her evident surprise, and helping her.
Martin Zimmer, Eden's leader since the abolition of the presidency some 10 years ago, personally rededicated this shrine as his first official act. And he undertook to make certain that every item stored within was perfectly maintained out of his deep personal respect for the heroic Dr. John Rourke.
The tour guide seemed to end every sentence, almost every word, with a big toothy smile. This time was no exception.
I haven't seen any pictures of Martin since.
The girl with him looked positively shocked, eyes like saucers behind her enormous glasses.
He's never seen in public. He was terribly disfigured, the poor man, during the war with the outlaws in the wildlands.
That's right. Silly me for not remembering.
Down three steps and in the center of the vast central chamber, there were illuminated cases. As the people from the tour broke up, he started toward the cases, the young teacher still beside him.
Just like a man. Look at all the cowboy toys.
He smiled, shrugging his shoulders. He took off his sunglasses, peering into the largest case. He saw two shiny stainless steel pistols. Below them, a printed label reading, Detonics Combat Master 45 Automatic Pistols used by John Rourke on the day of the Great Conflagration to shoot down the last Soviet helicopter gunship. Nearby lay a long-barreled revolver, 44 Magnum, simply labeled Smith & Wesson Model 629. Below these sat a little black knife bearing the label A.G. Russell Sting 1A Black Chrome, alongside a large fighting survival knife with a label beneath it reading Handmade Life Support System 10 by Jack W. Crane of Weatherford, Texas, circa late 20th century. Finally, a pair of dark-lensed aviator-style sunglasses seemed to look approvingly over the display. He smiled and turned to the girl.
It's not that your invitation doesn't flatter me, because you're very attractive. But I'm afraid I've got something to do tonight.
Hey, I've got a health card. I'm not hard up.
No, I'm sure you're a real prize, honestly.
He looked back into the case, then put on his sunglasses. Weapons detectors monitored every public space in Eden and its capital, Eden City. Every public building, nothing was privately owned, included monitors at every access point. Police surveillance cameras monitored every intersection. Black and white police vehicles patrolled, and the police seemed heavily armed. As he walked from the station at the foot of Rourke's Mountain toward the bullet train station that would return him to Eden City, he passed through two security arches. Before they left the retreat, the tour guide pointed out to them one of the secret tunnels connecting the mountain summit above with the interior of the retreat.
It was this escape tunnel that Dr. Rourke used to re-enter the retreat in the very instant the sky caught fire.
A little boy shook off his pretty young mother's hand and tried to climb into the hatch. The escape hatch was open, but covered in synth glass. The tour guide smiled indulgently, bending over to get her face even with the little boy's, showing everyone behind her what was under her mini-dress in the process.
You want to do just like you saw John Rourke do in that movie, don't you? Well, remember, it wasn't really John Rourke who did it. It was Lance Stone who played John Rourke. Or maybe it was his stuntman.
The pretty girl who invited him for dinner and sex, she hadn't really mentioned dinner, sat beside someone else on the way back down the mountain and walked away quickly when the bus returned to the departure station for the tour. He left quickly as well, boarding the same bullet train, but in a different car, using his round-trip ticket. He studied the brochure the young woman gave him.
The retreat, owned by the government of Eden. Tours leaving every hour on the hour, every Monday, Wednesday, and Saturday. First tour 10, last beginning at 6. A real moneymaker.
The statue atop Rourke's Mountain was just as pictured on the cover of the brochure, and in the video he watched aboard the bus. The end of the historical reenactment, starring Lance Stone, showed Stone in a pose identical to that of the statue. Stone's face dissolved into the face of the statue. Since Stone's face looked nothing like the statue's, he wondered if someday they would change the face of the statue to match. The man sitting beside him was evidently a shift worker, using the bullet train to get to his job. A plastic lunchbox and an open newspaper, The Gates of Eden, on his lap. The man's eyes were closed, and evidently he was asleep. The train moved fast and smooth. The very rhythm of it would have made falling asleep easy. He did not fall asleep, however. John Thomas Rourke had slept enough to last him for a very long time. They were all present, but the one he now realized mattered most to him. Paul and Annie sat together. Michael and Natalia sat together. John sat alone. Far away, in China, the last place anyone would think to look, sat two chambers, still unopened. Sarah hovered between life and death in one of them. The man who the head of German intelligence said was his best agent, Manfred Kohl, smoked a cigarette. Kohl was tall, lean, athletic-looking, and young, but he sat with his shoulders slumped and his eyes closed behind his glasses, the very picture of an old man deep in thought. James Darkwood paced the floor between where Kohl and John sat. How much like Jason Darkwood this young man looked. It was uncanny. Had this been a 20th-century motion picture, rather than a 26th-century reality, and they'd all been actors, like Lance Stone, a.k.a. John Rourke, this James Darkwood and his ancestor Jason Darkwood could have been played by the same man. James Darkwood was still a commander, not yet a captain, and although he was likely quite at home on a midwake submarine, his business was naval intelligence. Kohl opened his eyes.
So, you have seen the place, John. Everywhere you are enshrined, but what you stood for is debased.
Martin Zimmer. When the young American from Midwake died in my arms, he said the word cry. Or at least I thought he did.
From what we are able to determine, it would have been possible for the man you followed almost 125 years ago. This...
He closed his eyes, raised his face to the ceiling as though consulting a notebook, and opened his eyes again to continue.
His name was Armand Gruber, yes?
Natalia nodded.
What we have learned by sifting through computer records indicates that Gruber could have had access to German and Midwake research in cryogenics. The original Zimmer was a man well ahead of his time. When he died, most of the knowledge of his microsurgery procedures and his research in genetic surgery went to the grave with him. Now, it would not be stretching credibility to assume that if he had the basics of cryogenics, Zimmer could have duplicated the cryogenic chambers and the all-important serum. He could have somehow survived.
It couldn't be. We saw his body, and even if he could have rigged it in some way, there was his retina print. You said yourself that it couldn't have been faked.
If Bob Jessop was trying to say the word cryogenics instead of cry...
What about the brother theory?
His DNA typing could indeed have been achieved through murdering his brother. Zimmer had one, who was also a Nazi, and there are no records of Zimmer's brother ever being arrested or any grave found for him. But that still leaves us with the eye.
Damn it!
James Darkwood stopped pacing.
I read the autopsy reports concerning Zimmer and Dodd. We know that Dodd's was faked, of course, because Dodd resurfaced in the aftermath of President Kuranami's death, telling some wild story about Zimmer kidnapping him and putting in a ringer for him. Then the ringer and Zimmer get killed.
You still have the eye?
Annie stood up, stabbing her hands along her thighs, looking for pockets, John surmised. But the attire worn by Eden women, essentially identical to clothes worn in the 1960s, didn't include pockets because it fit so tightly. Her dress was shockingly short, he thought. Even though she was a married woman, she was still his daughter.
The eye thing is impossible to duplicate.
James Darkwood looked at her and smiled.
What if he actually sacrificed his own eye? The other eye was missing. Zimmer was a crack shot, the records say, a rifleman. Manfred found a photograph that showed Zimmer firing right-handed. He could have fired a pistol right-handed and had a left master eye, but not a rifle. What if he felt... proving his own death actually merited the loss of an eye. After all, he was into microsurgery, right? We can clone a human eye today and replace it. Maybe he could do it then, or figured the process would be an inevitable development he could wait for.
John just listened. Who was Martin Zimmer? That was the real question. All the rest about Dietrich Zimmer and his missing eyeball, about cryogenics, all of that was essential, but could wait. Martin Zimmer was building an arsenal of chemical and energy weapons that could unleash devastation paralleling the night of the war. He had the largest standing army in the world, and no nation on Earth could stand up to him because he already had nuclear weapons, the munitions of the Defense Recovery Emergency Armed Deterrent Program, or DREAD. Reportedly, even before deploying those, he launched a building program creating tactical nuclear weapons, battlefield superiority weapons. To challenge the buildup, to threaten interdiction, might have forced Zimmer to launch the old DREAD weapons. In a century and a quarter, the environment was considerably restored, but still sufficiently fragile that Eden's capabilities under Martin Zimmer could bring about an annihilation of the species. Zimmer's armies and air forces stood poised, ready, and no one knew his face.
What are you thinking, Daddy?
John let a wan smile cross his face. He looked at his daughter.
About how little things really change.
If we announce your return, John, with the way in which Martin Zimmer virtually deified you, the people of Eden would...
They would think I'm an imposter, an actor, just like Lance Stone in their damn movie. When the medical people in China saw that my brainwave patterns were back in the normal range, your government and the government of Midwake figured your problems were solved. Awaken me, awaken Paul and Annie and Michael and Natalia. Gee, sorry nothing can be done for Sarah Rourke yet, but we're still working on that, and you can go back to the sleep if you want to later, but right now we want you to overthrow Martin Zimmer. No. No, it's not that simple. If Martin Zimmer somehow could be Dietrich Zimmer, or even if there's a connection, there's something considerably more important to me than world peace to consider right now. You said what little background data exists on Martin Zimmer indicates he may have been a doctor. So, if he is Dietrich Zimmer, or Dietrich Zimmer's pupil, the microsurgery techniques Dietrich Zimmer supposedly took with him to the grave could be just what's needed to reach that bullet lodged in my wife's brain and free her.
You want to...
Darkwood looked at Cole.
I was right, wasn't I? 5 generations ago, Jason Darkwood wrote his memoirs of a life at sea and his adventures with John Warwick in the closing days of the war. You should have read those memoirs, Manfred. I tried to tell you John Warwick doesn't take orders. He does what he thinks is best.
Darkwood clapped Manfred Cole on the shoulder.
And you're shit out of luck.
They rode in relative silence. A father and son who at least once were both in love with the same woman, and their faithful Jewish companion, as Paul Rubinstein often thought of himself. Paul looked down at the journal page before him and began to write.
We are passengers in what these days pass for a delivery truck, taking fresh supplies of souvenirs and candy to the retreat. Again, Manfred Cole became considerably bent out of shape. He told John that breaking into the retreat to retrieve his old weapons was silly. John was very patient with him, explaining that not only were the weapons he'd always carried the best to be had, even if there were more modern ones, but that the psychological value against Martin Zimmer was important. Martin would wonder who broke into the retreat, for what purpose. Putting the dictator of Eden even a little off balance was to everyone's benefit, John insisted. I don't know if Manfred Cole agreed with him or not. I suspect the latter, but he acquiesced. I was, frankly, very worried when we were first awakened from the sleep. Worried over the situation concerning Michael and Natalia. How would John accept this? It was always clear that John loved Natalia, but equally clear that because of his personal code of honor, that love could never be consummated while Sarah lived. Does Sarah live? Her heart and lungs still function at the prescribed rate for cryogenic maintenance, and her brainwave pattern is normal considering the trauma she endured. I worry that if Sarah is revived, she might not be the same person. What damage might have been done to her brain by the bullet? At the time, we were assured that the physical damage was very little and that the problem was that the bullet could not be removed. But what if those medical opinions were in error? Now, with Michael and Natalia lovers, and that is obvious, the possibility exists that John might be forever alone. John still amazes me. Michael and Natalia approached him after the initial stages of our recovery from the sleep. Michael held a hand. He let go of a hand, stepped in front of her, and told his father that he and Natalia were in love, and consummated that love. John sat there very quietly for a moment. I didn't quite know what to expect. My wife, Annie, held my hand so tightly I could feel the circulation slowing. Then, John said, and I think I'll remember his words until I go to the grave. I love you, Michael. I love you, Natalia. Now I can love both of you as one. And he stood, with some difficulty because the body relearns movement slowly after the sleep, embraced Michael, then embraced Natalia and kissed her cheek. He shook his son's hand. I cannot imagine a man handling such a situation in a finer or better way than he did. Here, in Eden, the people sing John Rourke's praises, regardless of the motive, for his heroism. His bravery is something I would never deny. But the more I learn about my friend, the more I realize that his real greatness is in his humanity. Something no statue, no guided tour, no face on postage stamps, a coinage, a currency could ever convey.
The truck stopped.
Gentlemen?
John drew the Detonic Scoremaster Annie loaned him from his trouser band. The rear doors of the truck opened.
Let's go.
Using the German climbing equipment and the fact they all knew each face of the mountain facilitated their ascent, despite the moonless night. The only electronic security they encountered, not overly precise due to the abundant repopulating wildlife in the area, guarded the fence surrounding the base of the mountain itself. Bridging the fence without interrupting its current allowed them easy access. The new German climbing boots, the advanced crampons, and the fact that for better than 50% of the distance they needed no climbing gear at all and could walk, reduced the ascent time to under 2 hours.
There's no electronic security on the summit, except for a video camera on the far side. By keeping low and going in front of the statue, we'll be undetectable.
They approached the statue, the first time for Paul and Michael.
The face on the statue is pretty lifelike. I think you ought to lose the beard, Dad. Just a suggestion.
John turned around, said nothing. In the darkness, Paul could not see his face, but he agreed with Michael. The full beard John grew to disguise his now very recognizable face just wasn't him. Keeping to knees and elbows, they crawled past the base of the statue, past the escape hatch John used before and after the event the statue depicted, aiming for the far side of the mountain's summit, well out of range of the video surveillance. They arrived at a large flat stone surrounded by several smaller stones. Michael began moving the smaller stones away. John and Paul each grabbed at the end of the large stone.
If we do this right, we'll be in and out, and they'll never know how we did it. That should make our Martin Zimmer even more upset.
Michael joining them, they moved the flat stone into a tarp John laid out on the rocky surface beside it, so there would be no scuff marks on the stones.
Where'd this come out again?
Michael Rourke knew the retreat as well as his father, having been its master for all the years while his father returned to the sleep. Michael and his sister grew up there. Going first through the tunnel, climbing down in near total darkness except for the small flashlight he held clamped in his teeth, he reached the interior vault closure and began to work the combination.
Almost got it.
Where do we come out? Oh, I remember. That takes a sick mind to think of something like that.
I'll grant you, devious.
Michael drew open the door and aimed his flashlight at the back of the object that masked the secret entrance.
Remember, push on your right side and swing it to your left.
I remember.
The toilet's flush tank swung away, and Michael Rourke drew back. There was no light, no sound. He decided to go for it. He stepped through, feeling with his foot first that the toilet lid was down, only putting part of his weight on it, then stepping down to the floor. If there were motion or pressure sensors, their entry would be detected. The flashlight in his teeth again, Michael held one of his Berettas in each hand. His father came through the opening, then his brother-in-law.
We can't risk lights because a power surge would be detected. There are motion sensors by the main entrance, but I can't get my Harley up the escape tunnel anyway, so there's no need to go to the main entrance. The video cameras probably aren't monitored continuously, so let's hope they don't catch the flicker.
They started getting out of their backpacks. Getting past the video camera was the hardest part, and Michael stood beside it now, balanced precariously on top of one of the gun cases, the AB switch in hand. Coaxial cable was vastly changed over what he remembered. But he had rehearsed this at the house on the outskirts of Eden City that James Darkwood secured as a very temporary safe house for them. Using the pliers from his Leatherman tool, Michael worked loose the locking nut, then readied himself to jerk the coax free of the camera feed. He was double-gloved now, rubber below leather to avoid leaving fingerprints. These days, sophisticated laser scanners routinely picked up latent prints left through a porous glove, a technology pioneered in the late 20th century. He jerked the coax free and pushed the single feed end of the AB switch into place, leaving the lock nut until later. In the next instant, he pushed the coax onto one of the receptacles on the other end of the AB switch. No siren sounded, no lights flashed on, but he didn't for a moment feel safe. Paul Rubinstein had his AB switch in position on the second video surveillance camera, then tightened the lock nut. The video equipment they were attaching would be their gift to the government of Eden. It was cheap Russian equipment, suited to the task, but so ubiquitous as to be untraceable. Paul climbed down off the kitchen counter, checking his connection to the video recorder. He hit the AB switch's remote, and the switch moved to the center position. The feed from the camera went to both coax lines, the one leading along to the main entrance of the retreat and the one leading down to his recorder. His fingers poised over the play and record buttons. When the camera reached its farthest rearward swing, Paul pushed play and record. The same feed that ran along coax to the security station went into the recorder as well. He looked at his watch, timing a full rotation of the camera from starting point back to starting point at 1 minute and 52 seconds. He tapped out the numbers on a calculator, then leaned against the wall and waited. John Rourke reached the summit and climbed out into the cold night air. Annie's Detonic Scoremaster in his right fist, the Smith & Wesson Centennial in his belt on its hip grip, a pack on his back, another in his left hand. The packs contained his twin stainless Detonics 45s, the 629 and suppressor-fitted 6906, the Crane LS-10, his Russell Sting 1A Black Chrome, his SSG sniper rifle, home movies of the kids, the Rourke family Bible, John's copy of Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged, sheaths, holsters, spare pistol grips, and John's aviator sunglasses. Keeping from the sight of the video surveillance camera, John took a moment to look up into the night sky. With no moonlight, and the only artificial light from hundreds of feet below, the star fields were brilliant diamonds set against black velvet. He thought about the two women he had loved in his life, and perhaps both of them were forever lost to him. Certainly Natalia was. He'd wanted this to happen, intentionally used the cryogenic chambers after the great conflagration to bring his son and daughter to adulthood, so Annie could wed Paul, and so Natalia could wed Michael. He hoped Natalia would find a bond with Michael. He wanted it, feared it, and now it had happened. Happiness and sadness could sometimes be one. Stars altered their paths slightly over the years, as did men and women, and had he the means, he would have calculated how much subtle variation existed between the patterns among the stars now and then. John watched the stars a moment longer. In the 6 centuries that passed since he first viewed the stars from the summit of this mountain, his question was still unresolved. While they rested in cryogenic sleep, Commander Dodd instituted a dictatorship, and during the long years of his dominion, resentment grew in Eden. So did its population. The former was a natural result, the latter was planned. Out of both grew a resistance to tyranny, a movement forced into the wildlands for survival. John Rourke watched the terrain below the now antique J-7V, Cole at its controls. Eden lived up to its name, a garden of lush green. The summers were still short and cool, the winters still long and cold, but the tree cover returned. The area looked like the Georgia of the latter decades of the 20th century, rather than the barren wasteland he woke to after the first sleep in the immediate aftermath of the great conflagration. In that respect, the regreening, Dodd and his successors did well. Rourke always felt the devil was worth his due. John's eyes shifted back into the cabin. James Darkwood slept, but young Darkwood had been up nearly all the night, and unlike the rest of the cabin's occupants, had not come out of a century and a quarter's cryogenic repose. Annie did needlepoint. Oddly, so did Natalia, although with evidently less practice. He smiled, thinking about that. Not something that was probably given great emphasis at the Chicago Espionage School 6 centuries ago in the Soviet Union, needlepoint. Perhaps cross-stitch instead. Michael and Paul played chess, happily still a pastime for people everywhere. John returned to his notes. A century and a quarter's worth of history wasn't assimilated in a moment. Dodd's plan, or was it Dietrich Zimmer's, was to increase the population of Eden exponentially through immigration of carefully selected groups and through a rigidly enforced policy of sexual exploitation of women. Today in Eden, women had no political rights. Like men, they owned little else but the clothes on their back. Today, economic incentives replaced harsher methods. Today, women were given a cash payment and tax credit for every child they brought into the world. When Dodd was just getting started, women who refused to bear children were forced to do so. He understood the woman who tried to pick him up on the bus. She wanted to be made pregnant. Although artificial insemination was available to any woman who chose it, it was forced on women of childbearing age. If they did not become pregnant by more conventional means, alternative punitive taxes were levied. Over half the young women he saw in Eden were pregnant. When Dodd took over, he proceeded to activate Dread, but in secret. Over the intervening decades, the Soviet Union, prohibited from building nuclear weapons, allied itself with New Germany and Midwake for protection against Eden. Eden possessed the Soviet nuclear weapons seized after conquering the Soviet underwater complex. New Germany armed itself, a technologically simple task, and shared the technology on a give-and-take basis with Midwake. The alliance between Midwake and New Germany reminded Rourke of the relationship between the United States and Great Britain before the night of the war. All but perfect mutual trust, tempered with a little espionage between good friends, to be sure. Resistance to Dodd's policies led some of the Eden returnees, some of the immigrants from Midwake, whom Dodd could not prohibit, although he apparently tried, and some of the Russians to abandon Eden proper for the wildlands. Unlike the settlers of America's frontiers centuries earlier, these immigrant pioneers brought with them considerable technological sophistication, and most importantly, the ability to duplicate it. Meanwhile, the ranks of Dodd's supporters grew through the help of immigrants from New Germany who were Nazi sympathizers and through the educational programs installed at Eden. Brainwashing into Dodd's brand of National Socialism began at the earliest possible moment. Soon, all non-whites either fled Eden or disappeared. Dodd's replacement, Arthur Hooks, carried on in Dodd's footsteps almost as if one were the clone of the other, expanding the baby farming program, deepening the tyranny. The average woman in the 50 years following Dodd's accession to office bore 7.5 children each. The circumstance also contributed to the decline in women's rights, because the life expectancy for women lowered by almost 9 years. By Hooks's administration, Eden fully deployed the nuclear arsenal of dread. Although New Germany and Midwake wished to crush Eden's tyrannical government and restore freedom there, the risk of nuclear devastation was too great. Midwake encouraged population growth rather than demanding it, and Midwake itself grew. No longer did citizens of Midwake wish to return to their ancestral homeland in what was once the United States and was now, ironically, known as Eden. Instead, they repopulated the Hawaiian Islands, then Australia, but the undersea city of Midwake remained the capital. Many Soviets from their undersea culture, once mortal enemies of the Americans of Midwake, joined with the people they once fought, creating no separate colonies, but commingling to swell the populations of Hawaii and Australia. A small percentage of Germans from New Germany, in Argentina, set out to what was called Gaul, where the wild tribes of Europe lived. Their goal was to rebuild historic Germany. With the help of the people of the Soviet underground city, not only did historic Germany become a reality, but the two peoples, in many ways, became one. The world arrayed now into two armed camps. On one side, the Trans-Global Alliance, led by Midwake, including the states of Hawaii, Australia, and New Zealand, and New Germany, including the state of European Germany. Committed to this alliance, as well, were the Russian Ural Republic and the Russian Pacific Republic. On the opposite side stood Eden, the greatest military power on Earth. Eden extended along the eastern half of what was once the United States, from Maine to what remained of Florida after the Great Earthquake, but surpassed those boundaries into what had been Canada and the Caribbean nations in northern Brazil. The only neutral nation on Earth, sympathetic to the Trans-Global Alliance, but not a member, was Lidveldid Island. Yet Iceland's very borders were at risk. The southern tip of what was once Greenland was now occupied by Martin Zimmer's Eden troops. Periodically, Eden aircraft would cross into Lidveldid Island's airspace, and Lidveldid Island would file a diplomatic protest. Only because the Trans-Global Alliance was committed to Icelandic freedom did the tiny island nation remain free. Portions of the world were still radioactively hot no-man's lands that only a lunatic with a death wish would enter. Other areas, in some ways inhospitable, had become havens for fragmentary population groups. The wild tribes of Europe were assimilated culturally into historic Germany. Rourke had been pleased to learn that Natalia's school was now the site of a Wild Tribes cultural center, the building and grounds named in her honor. Other small groups, most notably the people who left Eden and dissenters from the Russian Ural Republic, lived away from organized government, forming their own societies. Russian dissenters, still believing in communism, set up communal societies in Western Europe and Northern Africa. The Eden exiles, except for very small groups in the deep snows of the Tennessee Mountains, lived in confederations of communities stretching from what once had been Montana to New Mexico and into northern Mexico. The societies here were as diverse, Cole and Darkwood said, as thumbing through the pages of a history book, or perhaps a psychology book. To the west of the wildlands were the great salt marshes where the Pacific, in the aftermath of the destruction of California, encroached upon the low-lying desert. To the east, between the wildlands and Eden, there was a radioactive wasteland that followed generally the course of the Mississippi River. But in the wildlands, in the last decade, there grew a new menace, one more immediate than accidentally stumbling into a radioactive hotspot. That menace was the land pirates. The land pirates, some of them said to be descendants of the Russians of the KGB Elite Corps and the Marine Spetsnaz, others of various ancestry, traded in precious stones and precious metals for technology and flesh. Slavery flourished in some portions of the wildlands, sexual slavery the most prevalent and the most insidious. Everywhere on the planet, people were obsessed with increasing their numbers. Intelligence data gleaned independently by New Germany and Midwake suggested that Zimmer, who allowed the land pirates to exist, was effecting an alliance with them. His purpose was uncertain, although it seemed obvious, at least, that with the land pirates as allies, he could subdue the wildlands without bothering to commit vast numbers of troops. And there was a chance, however dubious, that Martin Zimmer was in the wildlands now, conferring and working strategies with his new allies. To see Martin Zimmer's face would be worth any personal risk, because if this man somehow used cryogenics and was Dietrich Zimmer, then there was a score to settle for the murder of a child more than a century ago. And yet, Zimmer's talents as a surgeon might be the only way to save Sarah from her living death. Tired but not ready for sleep, John lit a cigar in the blue-yellow flame of his battered Zippo. The thought of knowing the face of Martin Zimmer at once drove him onward and frightened him more than anything ever frightened him in his bizarrely long life.
Have I lived too long? Well, that's not for me to say. Death comes in its own time, in its own way.
John put away his notes, then reached into the pack near him, pulling out one of the scoremasters. He had detail stripped, cleaned, and oiled the little combat masters, but left the other guns for the long, slow, zigzagging flight to the wildlands. He removed the .45's magazine, drew back the slide, and confirmed that the chamber was empty, then moved the slide in line with the disassembly notch and started to push out the slide stop. The sun was up, and just about now, someone would be noticing that certain items within Martin Zimmer's little museum at the retreat were missing. When Martin Zimmer learned just what was missing, he might experience the same uncomfortable feeling Rourke did when thinking about Zimmer. In addition to pioneers and land pirates, Allied intelligence agents roamed the wildlands. Three of the agents, a man and two women, bundled in heavy clothing against the sub-zero temperatures and high winds, met the J-7V as it touched down on the circle of ice. The pad had been cleared and iced over to keep blowing and drifting snow from accumulating. As Rourke stepped from the V-stall aircraft and pulled up his parka's snorkel hood, the ice beneath his feet was so slick he could barely stand. He stepped back, sat briefly on the accommodation steps, and secured ice creepers to the soles of his boots. Before the night of the war, this had been suburban St. Louis, Missouri. The city was neutron-bombed, and despite the fires of the great conflagration and five intervening centuries, some ruins still stood. Not far from here were places where the radiation levels were still so high that exposure would mean certain slow death.
Better put on ice creepers!
The creepers in place, he went aft along the fuselage to begin unpacking the gear stowed there. Michael joined him. They quickly unloaded and stacked the gear. Rourke looked over his shoulder. Paul, with the two women, went over to meet the reception party with Cole and Darkwood. Rourke's skin tingled slightly where he shaved away the full beard and mustache just a few hours ago. John and Michael stacked the gear away from the aircraft in the event the J-7V had to take off rapidly, then headed over to join the others. The three agents, one of the women was a German, the other woman and the male agent from Midwake, were just finishing shaking hands with Paul and Annie and Natalia.
This woman is the best field operative in the wildlands, and she's not even from Midwake, dammit.
John turned to face the woman, the first time he had seen her eye to eye. Her gray eyes locked on his face in a mixture of terror and revulsion. She was somewhere in her late 40s or early 50s, he surmised, long gray streaks in what little of her dark brown hair was exposed beneath the front of her parka hood.
This is a sick joke, James.
Sick joke? Do you know who this is?
Him and this one.
She pointed to Michael.
The mustache is really cute.
What do you say, Hilda?
Manfred, you received my report a little earlier than I thought, I suppose. But where did you find these two?
What do you mean?
You know perfectly well what I mean, you damned fool. And with that face, if you are seen around here with any of the locals, you'll be shot, or worse, for...
I thought the people of Eden revered the face of John Rourke.
The people of Eden aren't the people of the Wildlands.
Tell me now, Hilda, what was in that report that you think we've seen?
Hilda looked at Darkwood oddly, then shrugged her shoulders.
If you have not read it, this is the strangest coincidence in history, and, like most people of my profession, I do not believe in coincidence.
What was in the report, Hilda?
The land pirates struck a town about 100 miles north of here almost a week ago. We got there when the town was in flames. The children had been kidnapped, and the men and the old people tortured to death. The women of childbearing age got kidnapped, of course. We found a few people alive, older people, but all of them dying. Margie and Dan and I tried to get what information we could out of them because the land pirates have been a lot more active in the last several weeks.
Get to the point!
Fine. The point, Mr... What was your name again?
Rubenstein!
Part of the joke. I get it. All right, good. I asked a dying old woman if she could tell me anything that could help us. She could not talk, I realized in the next instant, because they had cut out her tongue. Oh, Jesus.
The old woman?
She drew with her finger in the snow and drew the word devil in English. Then she opened the palm of her hand. There was an Eden half dollar in her hand. It was the last thing she did before she died. Very carefully, she set the coin face up inside the letter D, and then she tried making a word, but she died.
What did the word sound like?
Rourke is what it sounded like. And it was John Rourke's face. His face. And his face. Without that mustache.
Hilda pointed to John Rourke and then to Michael Rourke.
The devil, huh? Maybe.
John's face adorned the Eden half dollar. Michael's face looked exactly like it, except for the mustache. But who else's face was it? The group sat at an old table in the more than 6 centuries old police station's basement. Annie got the feeling that the German woman, Hilda, still somehow doubted the men sitting across from her were really John Rourke, Michael Rourke, and Paul Rubenstein. The question that Natalia was really Natalia Tyomarovna and Annie was really Annie Rourke never came up. It was only logical, Annie supposed, for the woman to question, given 125 years of disinformation. That they were sitting in this room was thanks to the foresight of Jason Darkwood. After Annie, Paul, Michael, and Natalia decided to join John and Sarah in the cryogenic sleep, Jason Darkwood, who was in charge of security for the original cryogenics operation that placed John and Sarah in suspended animation, determined that someday his own security would fail. With the acquiescence of his then-superior officer, Admiral Ron, and key persons in authority in Midwake, New Germany, and the Chinese First City, Captain Jason Darkwood devised a plan. Then, with the help of Marine Captain Sam Aldridge, First Officer of the USS Reagan, Sebastian, Field Marshal Wolfgang Mann, and Han Lu Chen of China, Darkwood carried out that plan. When she read Jason's accounts, Natalia thought part of his plan rather grisly. Jason arranged for duplicate cryogenic chambers containing dead bodies, 3 male and 3 female. all matched approximately the correct size of John, Sarah, Natalia, Michael, Paul, and Annie.
The substitutes were masked with prosthetic makeup. Then, with the help of the crew of the Reagan, we transported the entire Rourke family by submarine in total secrecy to the last place I thought potential killers would look, yet where I was certain proper security measures could be enforced. This was the Chinese first city. After Sam Aldridge's and Tom Stanhope's Marines put the six chambers and all necessary monitoring and spare parts equipment in place, Han Luchen and a hand-picked team of Chinese security personnel took charge of their safety.
Recent information described a secret service in China now known simply as the Watchers, who until this new awakening kept the vigil. Natalia held these men and women in the deepest respect because for over a century they safeguarded the lives of the Rourke family. And Jason's security measures proved prophetic when, less than 30 days after the transfer of the cryogenic chambers, simultaneous attacks in Midwake and Eden nearly destroyed the Midwake cryogenic installation, while the Eden attack led to the assassination of Akiro Kuranami, his wife Elaine Halverson, and eight other Eden Project returnees. After linking the Rourke team up with the Allied agents in the Wildlands, Cole and Darkwood left, flying their J-17V west. If it was discovered by one of Eden's spy satellites or the occasional high-altitude intelligence overflight, it would appear to have stopped for refueling or some sort of repair rather than to drop off infiltrators. Now, the five of them were on their own with the three intelligence agents, Hilda the German and the man and woman from Midwake, Dan and Margie.
The popular theory is that there were vast oil refineries and storage areas in the Great Rift Valley, and possibly more salt-domed strategic reserves. And there is evidence that there were explosives plants in the area as well. Anyway, it's not radioactive there, but whatever happened altered the course of the river. And when the firestorms came in the sky, of course, the river's above ground sources dried up, so its volume dried up. Whatever happened between St. Louis, here to the north, and Memphis to the south of us, in what was Tennessee, the river diverted. Erosion and other forces gouged out the riverbed, and some scientists theorized that the mid-continental fault ruptured and there was a quake. I do not know, but the result is a great rift valley where once the river flowed, but vastly deeper than the Mississippi River ever was, according to our best research. How deep?
Hilda looked over her shoulder.
300 meters in some places.
Earthquake.
Whatever. It's there. And right in the center, between here and Memphis, is the stronghold.
The land pirates?
No, the bad fairies. When I want to talk to a woman from Eden, I...
Paul stood up.
My wife, Hilda. Leave her alone before she rips your head off and craps down your neck. She's not from Eden. And if Eden women are a waste of your time, that's your problem, not ours. I'm in a bad mood. And don't push it, because I know what's coming. The only way in or out of the land pirate stronghold is through this valley, right? Tell me I'm fantasizing.
All right, then, mister. The land pirates have a way of their own, a route, through the valley. No one knows the way in. No one alive, at least, except for the land pirates. That is why I told Jason Darkwood and Manfred Cole that this was a fool's errand. No vehicle can get in or out of the stronghold because of the electrical activity. It is because of the radiation, I think. Something like what happened when the great conflagration occurred. The air is charged with too much electricity. I am not a scientist, but even if you could survive the radiation, it would do you no good. The electrical storms, when they come, are so powerfully magnetic, they will bring down an airplane or neutralize any sort of land vehicle.
How did the pirates get in?
John didn't expect an answer.
If they can get in, they must be going below the level of the storms. If the valley is as deep as you say it is in some places, they must have a route that keeps them deep enough within the valley that their vehicles are unaffected. Either that or shielding of some kind.
I am sure you are correct, whoever you are. But no one but the land pirates knows that route. So, there you are. It is useless. All of you would be well advised to wait here until Darkwood and Cole return to pick you up.
And you think that Martin is out there, conferring with the leaders of the land pirates?
I would bet my life on it. But, as I tried to tell Cole and Darkwood, we cannot get to him in the stronghold. There is no chance.
Paul got up and started pacing the room. He looked at Hilda.
What? Did the land pirates steal everything they have, or do they trade?
But of course they trade, my God. Why do you think they steal women of childbearing age? Even the land pirates couldn't use all of them themselves.
Then how is the trading accomplished? Do the land pirates go to the customers, or do the customers come to them?
The customers sometimes come to them. There is an active smuggling trade here, as you may know. Some say that Martin Zimmer actively encourages the trade to keep the land pirates occupied. The smugglers sell to the settlers because they are the only source of things like certain antibiotics, spare parts for weapons, like that.
They trade in women. The smugglers couldn't use all the women either.
Some of the women are ransomed back to their families by the smugglers, and the rest of them are used for baby farming. There's a premium on children, as I think I have said.
They smuggle women, which means they have to be able to get vehicles into the land pirate's stronghold that are large enough to carry a human cargo back out. It means they have a route. And maybe not the same one the land pirates use, but a route nonetheless. Who's the top slave smuggler, and where do we find him?
Michael clapped Paul on the back and then looked at Hilda.
Well?
The man is called Boris. Getting to see him is impossible. You do not know the wildlands. The three of us, Dan, Margie, and myself, we do. Boris doesn't just meet people.
What if we wanted to trade him a couple of women?
John looked at Annie and Natalia and winked.
In wonderful condition.
Annie and Natalia looked at each other, thinking they weren't going to like this. A map hung on the wall of what was once a cell in the basement of the old police station. The door had rusted off its hinges, and where once hung a barred window, the opening was now closed over with some type of metal to keep out the cold wind. On the map, crudely drawn, but likely accurate enough, Dan marked out a route with his finger.
East St. Louis, according to what I've read, was in another state before the night of the war. States were political subdivisions within...
Illinois. It was a nice enough town.
Sure. How was George Washington's inaugural party?
Oh, champagne was flat. We shouldn't need radiation gear to get over there, should we? So is that bridge your map shows us still usable? It looks like the most direct route.
It's guarded. 24 hours a day, it's guarded.
Anything sophisticated? Or just people?
People only. But they're tougher than you guys.
Oh, I don't know. We're pretty well rested.
Yes, we are indeed. I understand that the only plasma energy weapons out here in the wildlands generally are in the hands of the land pirates, just conventional stuff with smugglers. Is this Boris?
Enough conventional stuff to choke on, pal. Sure, some of it's hundreds of years old Soviet AKM-96 assault rifles, shit like that. And maybe you guys don't know much about guns, the old kind, projectile weapons, but they could hurt you.
Just those little tiny things they call bullets? I mean, I would imagine they could do that much damage, could they?
John realized his son had finally developed the Rourke family sense of humor that largely skipped John. John's father, Michael's grandfather, a kind man and gentle except when the situation called for something more, was always noted for his wit. It was good and bad, Annie's ability. The recent sleep only served to increase it. She could, without trying at times, read. At times, sometimes, when a loved one was in extreme danger, but with frustrating irregularity, she possessed empathic response. Sometimes she could make herself do it. Sometimes she would just get an impression. It was this now, as Annie changed clothes. Her father, John, for some reason, was thinking of his father, who served in the OSS, the World War II United States Office of Strategic Services. Annie never met her grandfather, but she knew the man, knew her father's impressions of his father, remembered the stories he would occasionally tell. Like father, like son, the old aphorism went. Her grandfather had a sense of humor that somewhat skipped his only child. Once, during World War II, deep behind enemy lines in Europe, Annie's grandfather spent the night hiding out in a jeweler's shop, and he hit on a rather bizarre idea. What would happen if officers in the Nazi high command thought there were assassins assigned to kill them? Would they try to make a lower profile for themselves, and could this reduce their efficiency and aid in the Allied war effort? He didn't know, but he emptied the magazine of his .45 automatic and engraved the names of seven of Hitler's top general staff officers on the bullets at the mouth of each cartridge, one man per round. Several days later, when he was in Berlin and posing as a German officer in the Wehrmacht in order to pick up information from an Allied agent working in deep cover, he left the first of the seven personalized rounds in the washroom. A bullet with your name on it would not be pleasant to find, he theorized. And correctly, it seemed. He left seven rounds to be found in conspicuous places around wartime Berlin. One of the officers committed suicide. Another, shortly afterward, was hospitalized for some sort of mental disorder. Still a third was fired from the general staff because of sudden inefficiencies in the performance of his duties.
What are you thinking about? Reading someone?
No, but I accidentally did. Daddy was thinking about his father.
That sounds silly.
What?
I always loved you like a sister, but...
Now we are. Almost, anyway.
Annie smiled. Intelligence data from the Wildlands was, to say the least, bizarre. The human habitations growing up here were a mixture of ridiculous and sublime. Communities where the level of technology was so low that conditions and attire were almost medieval. Entire areas where fundamentalist beliefs held such terrible sway that spiritual and physical freedom were non-existent, and the punishment for transgression was swift and deadly. Societies that intentionally retrogressed to eras that were perceived as happier, better. Natalia dressed in clothing made in New Germany, but based on intelligence data collected, no doubt, by Hilda and Dan and Margie. She wore an ankle-length dress, plain and of rough cloth, with long sleeves and high collar, of the sort worn by women and girls in some of the strictly religious communities where freedom of thought was non-existent. Annie, on the other hand, was dressed like a woman of Eden, miniskirted and booted. The story, when they were brought before Boris the slaver, was that Paul, the only man among them whose face would not be instantly recognizable, was a fugitive from Eden City. Annie was kidnapped from the city. Natalia herself was a woman he kidnapped from the community known as Heaven, along what had once been the Canadian border. And now, Paul wanted to sell the two women for some of the designer drugs and weapons Boris traded for women. Natalia, Annie beside her, stepped out of the passenger compartment of the all-terrain vehicle Paul drove. Michael and John climbed down out of the rear cargo area.
I'm freezing.
Annie wrapped a blanket around her over her skimpy clothes.
Why couldn't I be from the same place? This is the pits.
John and Michael joined them.
Once you're inside, just relax. We'll be there somehow.
I was never cut out to be a drug dealer.
Call it a career move.
They were 20 miles from the bridge leading over to East St. Louis. Natalia, cold as well, hugged her tattered blanket around her.
Are you ready?
Would you be ready, Michael?
Michael started to bind her hands behind her with a piece of rope.
I'd like to see you do this.
Got your knife?
Up the crack of my rear end, under my dress.
Remember to tie a square knot.
Right.
Tighter, Michael. If it's too loose, they'll notice it.
Let me know if I'm hurting you.
He turned her around, then gagged her with a handkerchief between her teeth. Then he tied another handkerchief over her eyes as a blindfold. Natalia felt Michael's lips touch her forehead, and then he started leading her toward the truck. Annie was bound the same way. Then Michael and Paul put the women in the back of the truck and threw blankets over them. Paul pulled to a stop on the Missouri side of the bridge. About 200 yards away from him, six men with AKM-96 rifles stood behind a barricade of logs and barbed wire. Barbed wire produced in Eden factories. The wire was shiny enough to be relatively new. Trade goods, he wondered.
Hey!
The group might be as disreputable looking a bunch of men as he'd seen since the old days when he and John fought the brigands in Texas.
I want to talk with this guy Boris. I got some shit in the back of the truck. I want to trade him.
The six men did nothing for a moment. Then two of them moved off to the right side of the bridge and began to confer. After a minute or more, one of the two shouted back,
What kind of shit you got? Pussy shit, that's what, man.
Paul came from a good home, and if his father, not to mention his mother, heard him now, especially considering one of the women in question was his wife, he would never have seen the sunrise.
We got plenty of pussy, man.
So take the fucks with you and get out!
Not like this you ain't! You pass this up and this poorest guy finds out what he missed! Your ass is grass, pal! I ain't talking trading goods for him to pass off to somebody. I'm talking fine stuff. He's gonna want to jump it himself.
Paul Rubinstein was trying to remember the dialogue from every third-rate movie he'd ever seen. So far, at least, he figured he was doing okay. But he was walking a narrow line, because if he made the captive women sound too exciting, he might wind up facing the six men here at the bridge, inciting them to want to kill him to get their hands on the women for themselves, or to make points with their boss. Under his coat, he had the battered old Browning high power, chamber loaded, of course, and his right hand near it. The second high power was in the same condition, but tucked into his waistband at the small of his back. Three of the six men clambered over the barricade, ducking the barbed wire with practiced expertise, it seemed, then started to approach the truck. Michael smiled. He was literally following in his father's footsteps. The riverbank was very narrow here, and if he didn't place his feet in the same spots his father did, he'd fall in. They were nearly to where the support columns for the bridge could be reached. So far, they'd gone undetected from the bridge above. Michael never saw Dan or Margie shoot, so he took little comfort from the fact that they were waiting on the roof of an abandoned building about 150 yards away with sniper rifles. Equipment, no matter how sophisticated, was no better than the woman or man who operated it. His father reached the pylon, swinging back beneath the bridge on the gravel and dirt. Michael joined him in the next instant. They both set to opening their packs and preparing their charges without uttering a word. Between them, in the packs they brought, there were six powerful charges of the latest German plastique. The bridge pylons were old enough that, as Michael rubbed his gloved hand over the nearest one to him, some of the concrete on the surface flaked away. They would be reinforced, of course, but the explosives would take care of the structural steel as well. They began setting the charges, moving through the girder work below the bridge, placing the charges on the insides of the pylons so the pylons would blow outward into the river, and the bridge section would entirely collapse. The long skirts of her dress were twisted around her legs, binding her almost as much as the rope on her ankles. And when the blanket was pulled off, aside from the sensation of light at the upper and lower edges of her blindfold, she was also instantly chilled.
What color is this bitch's eyes, you said?
Blue. Prettiest damn blue you ever saw. The other one. Oh, look at those legs, huh? She got brown eyes.
Yeah, Boris likes broads with blue eyes. Let's see them.
Fine, but that's all you see.
Look at that one. Her dress is all the way up. Let's check out her.
Keep your fucking hands off her panties, man. I came here with two virgins, and your boss gets to see him first.
Shit, asshole. They six of us and one of you.
You want to die first?
Take her damn blindfold off and let me see her eyes.
Natalia felt herself being manhandled into a sitting position. Her back ached with the sudden movement. Then the blindfold came down, and she squinted against the light. She felt hands at the back of her head, and as the blindfold ripped away, she lost a few hairs in the process. Her hair was longer than she'd worn it since she was a little girl, well past her shoulders now, and unbound, more than she could say for the rest of her. She opened her eyes. It wasn't acting. The light hurt her eyes, but it was the sight of the men standing beside Paul who nearly precipitated the scream. Dressed in rags and new clothes combined, but nothing fitting properly. Long, dirty hair, scraggly beards, each of them armed to the teeth. They looked like barbarians. Beside her, Paul was sitting up Annie, taking the blindfold from over her eyes.
Good looking, huh? This one's my personal favorite. Look at those legs. So long they could wrap around you twice, I bet.
Annie's eyes were as wide as saucers. Except for her panties, she looked naked from the waist down, her stockings intentionally shredded.
Your truck stays here.
The man was taller than Michael or John, and easily 1.5 times the size of either of them. As he reached toward Natalia, the smell of his body was overpoweringly strong.
I grabbed this one.
They'll walk, and we ain't going past the middle of the bridge. Now back the fuck off.
Paul produced a knife, put it in his teeth, grabbed at Natalia's dress and pushed it up to her knees, then cut the ropes at her ankles.
On your feet, bitch!
If she made it out of this alive, Natalia thought, she wasn't certain whether she would congratulate Paul on his hitherto concealed acting talents or feel like slapping him in the face. As he pushed her out of the truck bed, her feet were too numb to support her and she dropped to her knees in the gravel and dirt. Annie was beside her in the next instant, flat on her face in the snow.
Oof!
Come on, you two. Time to stretch those legs.
Paul dragged first Natalia to her feet, then Annie. Natalia swayed, still not certain her feet and legs would support her, but she was flexing her fingers. The man with the body odor twisted her around roughly and she almost fell, narrowly keeping her balance. His skin felt like leather as he grabbed at her wrists.
Tight enough.
Then his face was near hers, his mouth odor so bad she nearly vomited in his face.
Girl, it's like you don't be real good. We take some of that barbed wire and tie him up in it. Then we kick him around for a while. Feels real good.
She cast her eyes down for two reasons. It was probably what he expected her to do, and if she looked at him much longer, she would throw up.
Boris ain't gonna like coming down to the bridge. He's got shit to do.
Yeah, and I go walking in there with these. And I don't come walking out again. You tell Boris that I want plenty of antibiotics, some nose candy, and six AKM 96 rifles.
Six? For pussy?
Six for each one. Tell him. Or I pack up the truck. He hears what he missed with these two. Hell, I wouldn't want to be you guys. Probably get 6 or 8 kids out of each of them before he'd throw them away.
Natalia watched the men with whom Paul bargained. The two walked some distance away, Paul keeping his old Browning high power on them while they conferred. The key to the plans having any chance of success at all was that they didn't go into East St. Louis, never got off the bridge, that Boris came to them. And although she didn't like it, she realized that Paul was making a last gambit.
Look at this, man!
Paul's fist closed over the front of Natalia's dress and ripped it open almost to her waist. She wore a bra underneath, and that was all. He went to Annie and did the same thing. Natalia stood there, watching the men as they watched her and watched Annie, their eyes going farther than Paul had ripped.
All right, get him up to the barricade. Boris ain't gonna like it. I tell you that, man.
Paul only nodded.